This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Looking Back magazine. We're starting today's program with Yellow Gold. It's written by Vicki Tannabill. There are some people, lawn-proud gardening types, who frown at the sight of the first dandelion in their spring lawn. But not the kids in my old neighborhood back in the 1960s. Back then, we waited eagerly for the little yellow flowers to make an appearance because we had a neighbor who made dandelion wine, and he always let the neighbor kids help. Mr. S. owned a business just outside of town that was surrounded by lush green grass on all sides. When the weather was just perfect, sunny and dry, and the grass was covered with dandelions, he would put out a call for pickers, and the kids would come running, piling into his station wagon for the ride out of town. Nobody's parents minded, probably because they got a complimentary bottle of wine for loaning out their kids. The yellow flower heads were carefully picked, inspected for bugs, and dropped into brown paper grocery sacks. Just the flowers, not the leaves, which are too bitter for use for wine. Back homes, the bags went straight to Mr. S.'s basement, and the alchemy began. He put the flower heads into some crocks along with water, yeast, and lemon and orange slices. To sweeten the wine, Mr. S. ground up raisins in one of those old clamp-to-the-table meat grinders that everybody's mother used to have. Then he covered the crocks with cheesecloth and waited for the magic. Weeks later, the dandelion wine was strained and put up into dark green bottles with a printed label featuring a leprechaun. Mr. S. was as proud of his Irish heritage as he was of his five red-haired children. My dad loved the stuff so naturally, I couldn't wait until I was old enough for my first glass of that lovely pale green liquid. What a disappointment. It was bitter, and I wondered why anybody would drink dandelion wine. As time went on, though, I acquired a taste for it. I also discovered that the lowly dandelion has a long history of medicinal use, dating back to the earliest Arab physicians and herbalists who gave it its name. Speaking of names, the word dandelion comes from the French dentelion, or lion's tooth, a reference to the plant's sharp tooth leaves. It also is known as priest's crown, swine snout, blowball, witch groin, tail time, and clock flower. Both the English and French have mildly vulgar names for the plant that could be translated as wet the bed. The last name is a reference to the dandelion's well-known diuretic effect. Dandelions have been used for centuries to stimulate the kidneys and flush water from the body. Dandelion tea is particularly good for dieters plagued by water weight because it does not flush potassium from the body as other diuretics do. The dandelion has been used for centuries to detoxify the liver and treat gallbladder problems. It stimulates the production of bile and has been used to treat hepatitis and jaundice. Studies suggest that it can even lower cholesterol levels. People in my great-grandmother's generation used it as a spring tonic. Dandelion increases gastric juices and saliva and stimulates muscles in the intestine, which improves the appetite and digestive functions. That's why many people drink a cup of dandelion tea after dinner. Dandelion root also has a gentle laxative effect and is good for constipation. The Chinese use dandelion to treat breast inflammation and nursing problems, while Native Americans prize the plant as a remedy for PMS. Research indicates that the dandelion contains a substance called inulin, which may help stabilize blood sugar in diabetics. All parts of the dandelion plant, flowers, leaves, and roots have beneficial medicinal qualities. Because of the widespread use of weed killers these days, you might feel more comfortable buying your dandelion remedies than picking them. Dandelion is available in most health food shops in many forms, including extracts, teas, dried and powdered leaves and roots, and easy-to-take tablets and capsules. One of my favorite remedies uses fresh dandelions and is part of the plant you might be inclined to ignore. The stem of the dandelion contains a milky sap that has germicidal and fungicidal properties. This makes it marvelous for many skin problems. Dandelion sap is a very old and simple remedy for warts. Just rub the sap on the wart several times a day until the wart disappears. And don't be impatient. You can also use the sap on corns and calluses, blisters and insect bites, eczema and ringworm. My Aunt Lillian used the sap to remove her age spots, and she promised me that it would work on my freckles too. I liked my freckles, so I never tried it. Just be careful not to get the sap in your eyes. Fresh dandelion leaves, which are available in many supermarkets these days, are one of the healthiest foods you can eat. They contain vitamin C, D, E, K, most of the B's, and more A than a carrot, as well as minerals including calcium, phosphorus, iron, magnesium, potassium, and zinc. They also contain photochemicals and antioxidants that strengthen the immune system and protect against cancer and other diseases. Dandelions do taste bitter, but it's a taste you can learn to love. The smaller leaves are less bitter, as are leaves picked in early spring or after the first frost. You can add the leaves and flowers raw to salads, or you can serve them the way I do, wilted. Add 1/4 cup of cider vinegar and 2 teaspoons of sugar to 1/4 cup of hot bacon fat, and then pour over the greens. Season with salt and pepper to taste. You can also cook the leaves like spinach, and I've even heard of people frying the flowers in batter like zucchini blossoms. Dandelion tea is easy to make with purchased tea bags or by pouring boiling water over dried dandelion leaves and steeping for 5 minutes. A healthy and caffeine-free coffee substitute made from dandelion roots is surprisingly tasty, reminiscent of Southern chicory coffee. You can find it in health food shops or make your own from powdered roots. If you're not up to making dandelion wine, you can make a dandelion cordial very easily. Put 2 to 3 cups of dandelion flowers into a glass container and add 1/2 cup of sugar and the peel of 1 orange or lemon or both. Add 1 quart of vodka and cover the jar. Keep it dark and cool for a month and shake well daily. strain through cheesecloth, and put it in a clean bottle. This makes a great after-dinner alternative to dandelion tea, and it is very soothing after a too hearty meal. Dandelions have a long history of medicinal use and are considered very safe. However, people with allergies to ragweed and other plants may experience allergic symptoms. Likewise, some people with latex allergies may have a bad reaction to dandelion sap. Because of the plant's diuretic properties, it may affect the rate at which drugs are excreted from the body. Always check with your doctor before using dandelion products if you take prescription drugs or are being treated for a medical condition. There are some interesting bits of folklore surrounding the dandelion. The plant is sometimes called witch groin. Groin is a Scottish word for a yellow field flower, because it was believed that dandelions gathered on Midsummer Eve offered protection from witches. Another bit of folklore, which I remember from my own childhood, is the practice of blowing on white dandelion puffballs. If all the seeds fly off in one try, then your sweetheart loves you back with equal intensity. A third bit of folklore is based in fact. The plant was known as tail time and clock flower because the flowers open at 5 a.m. and close at 8 p.m., providing a handy natural clock for farmers and shepherds working in the fields. Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote that a weed is a plant whose virtues have not yet been discovered. The next time you're tempted to wage war on the lowly dandelion, remember its virtues and make some room on your lawn for this happy and healthy flower. Yellow Gold was written by Vicky Tannabill and includes this note. The information in this article is not intended to diagnose or treat ailments. Please consult your doctor before trying any home remedy. We're turning elsewhere in the May 2011 issue of Looking Back Magazine to World War II in the Ship's Belly. This is by Lois J. Rosa. My family didn't talk a lot about World War II. My mom's two brothers had been proud to serve. Uncle Dan had served in the Navy, and Uncle Ralph had been in the Merchant Marines. My uncles had only glowing things to say about their time in the military, but if you asked them what the war was like, they would only talk about what it was like at home or the camaraderie of shipboard life. They never spoke about the combat, the victims, or the fear. When I spent the night at my grandparents' house, I would sit up and talk to Nana about anything that popped into my head. One night the conversation was about World War II. "Why don't my uncles want to talk about it, Nana? Uncle Ralph was a merchant marine. They didn't actually go into battles, did they?" "They weren't supposed to, but you never knew what would happen out on the open sea," she said. "Sometimes they had to fight." "Was Uncle Ralph ever under fire?" "Funny you should ask. There was a peculiar thing that happened. One night I was sleeping, and I had something kind of like a vision. Your uncle was standing in a dark place with a shipmate. They were standing up to their waist in water. It seemed like the water was getting deeper by the minute. Well, I shot up in bed when I heard Ralphie's voice. He was telling me clear as day that he was hoping he was coming back, but he wasn't looking too good. He told me he loved me." Now, even though I had woke up, I could still see your uncle up to his chest in water by then. I yelled out and woke up your grandpa and told him what I saw. "Of course," he said, "I was dreaming, and not to worry. Ralphie was fine." "Did you forget about it?" I couldn't get it out of my mind. You know, it was so real. After a while, though, we heard from him, and he didn't say anything about it, so I just didn't think about it. But when your uncle's ship came into port at San Francisco, we went down to the docks to see our son and take a little tour of the ship. I was on board, and one of your uncle's shipmates caught me off to the side and told me that he knew my son loved me very much because of what happened when the ship took fire out at sea. They were below decks, and they were trapped down there with the water rising. They didn't think they were going to survive. He told me that your uncle told him he really loved his mother and that he wished he could tell me that and say goodbye. I asked him when it had happened, and sure enough, it was precisely when I had my dream. I was able to check it because the dream had disturbed me so much I had written it down in my journal. I went and checked, and sure enough, it was the same date. Did you and Uncle ever talk about it? Just once or twice. I guess the way your uncle felt, like he wasn't going to survive. Well, no one wants to remember times like that, feeling like that. The world seemed a lot bigger back then. Most mothers had a family member in Europe or the Pacific. We all were proud of our boys for being out there and fighting the good fight, but we were all petrified by the fear that our son, husband, or brother was going to die alone in some field and be buried in some unmarked spot. A lot of them didn't come back, Nana continued. Maybe there's a little bit of guilt in that. In those days, they fought wars face to face and looked their enemy in the eye. No, dear, there isn't a lot to talk about that's good about war. Your uncle's made it back in one piece. That's all that needs to be said. World War II, In the Ship's Belly, was written by Lois J. Rosa. And we're turning to Life with Chickens. In the 1930s, when we were young, the southeast room of our farmhouse was the coziest place to be. This is where the chicken incubators were set up. The heater that kept the eggs at proper temperature for hatching also made the room warm for us kids, Margaret, Alice, John, and me. It was here that we played, studied, or just read. We gathered eggs every day and placed them in the flat incubator chest to hatch. Opening the incubator doors on the front, we removed the trays inside and carefully helped fill them with eggs. Those eggs were turned daily and every week. Dad candled the eggs, holding each one up to a strong light and looking for shadows that meant a chick was forming. After 3 weeks, we watched excitedly as the chicks picked their shells with their egg tooth and eventually emerged, all moist and peeping. In the warmth of the incubator, they soon dried to soft, downy fluffs. We loved to cradle them and listen to them peep. Soon they were ready to be put into the brooder house, where they could scratch in the straw and keep warm under the umbrella-shaped tin hood that hung over a lantern reflecting a circle of warmth. They huddled there in a blanket of yellow fluff until disturbed. Then their little black beady eyes would open to our delight. We spent a lot of time there, cuddling the chicks and watching them peek at fresh spears of grass and nab the occasional bug. By summertime, we moved them into the hen house with the older hens. Here, straw-filled nest boxes and roost awaited them. At nighttime, their soft, sleepy murmurings as they perched on the roost gave us a soothing sense of peace. We gathered eggs every day, sometimes reaching under a hen to take her egg. our hens weren't allowed to brood a clutch of eggs, so whenever a hen insisted on staying in the nest to sit on her egg, we had to drag her out and carry her to the breaking up coop. This was somewhat like a jail with bare boards for the base. Putting squawking, flapping, clawing hens into that coop was my least favorite job. The broody hens didn't like it either. Sometimes they escaped our grasp, leaving us with scratched, bleeding arms. We kept a few roosters with the hens to ensure fertile eggs. The roosters strutted around the yard, crowing and vying to be head boss of the flock. The worst of the lot, old Feisty, chased us all around, nipping at our bare feet. We took to carrying a long switch to shoo him away. When a pesky rooster bothered us too much, he soon became soup. We sometimes heard the saying, "It's hot enough to fry eggs on the sidewalk." One hot day, after gathering the eggs, Sister Alice suggested that we fry a couple on the cistern's cement cover. When we cracked two eggs onto it, they really did fry on the hot cement. Our family earned a nice income from selling all those eggs, although our grandpa, J.W. Adair, frequently joked that we couldn't afford to eat eggs ourselves. Either their price was too high for us to use them, he claimed, or the price was so low that we had to sell all of them to make any money. Nevertheless, eggs were a mainstay of our diet, as were the chickens, which we ate fried, roasted, and in soup. We all agreed that Mom's fried chicken was the best. As we listened to its sizzle in hot bacon fat, our mouths watered in anticipation. Back then, we didn't make pets of our hens. 30 years later, though my husband, Walter, and I secured a few baby chicks for our children, Peter, Maria, and Diane, to care for. Those did become pets. When they grew up, we had no good place to keep them, so we took them to Grandpa and Grandma Gronick's home, and they were butchered. The girls were devastated and wouldn't eat chicken. We learned it's better to have cats and dogs for pets. There were many shortages during the Depression. However, on the farm, we had food. Back in the good old days, we kids knew that the work we did on the farm was really appreciated, especially feeding the chickens and gathering eggs each day. Life with Chickens was written by Dorothy Adair Gonick. And we're turning now to A House of Our Own. This is by Mary E. Hansen. My family had always lived in big cities, so moving to a mostly rural area outside Detroit, Michigan in 1937 proved to be something of a culture shock. But my parents were tired of paying rent, and so they decided to buy their own home. They bought a 2-acre lot facing a busy highway 2 miles from the small town of Farmington. However, when my father asked for a loan to build a modest house, the local bank officer turned him down. The reason? He didn't have a credit record. My father had always paid his bills on time and with cash, so he had never needed to borrow money. Now my parents owned property, but without the financial means to build a house. My father then heard of a Mr. Gergie, who sometimes loaned small amounts to deserving individuals. Mr. Gergie was a tall, erect, white-haired man with kind, dark brown eyes. He thought my father was a good risk, and he loaned him just enough money for a basic structure, simple, 2-story house with windows and exterior doors, but no interior walls or doors. My family then lived among the 2x4s. The upstairs consisted of one large room that became my bedroom on one side and the bedroom for my younger sisters, Virginia and Susan, on the other. There was no running water, so a large hand pump dominated the kitchen sink. Despite his inexperience, my father built temporary shelves to hold dishes and cooking utensils. An outhouse was built and painted green. Telephone service was on a party line. The Farmington High School that I attended from my sophomore to my senior year consisted of one brick building that had neither gymnasium, cafeteria, nor auditorium. We ate our bag lunches seated at desks in a large study hall that also served as a general assembly room and stage for our dramatic efforts. As I had always attended large city schools, my sophomore class of fewer than 100 students seemed tiny. But the instructors were enthusiastic, and for the first time, I became interested in my studies rather than my social activities. Our living conditions were primitive to us, but my parents, two sisters, and I rose to the challenge. My father planted an orchard, and my mother grew flowers around the green outhouse, which stood out in stark contrast during the winter snows. Mr. Gergie also approved of our attitude and progress the following year. He loaned my parents enough money to complete our home. They soon added a vestibule, dormer windows, interior walls, an indoor bathroom, utility room, modern kitchen, and garage. My family lived in the Cape Cod-style house until 1942, when we moved to Southern California. The unincorporated area where we once lived is now the town of Livonia, and a shopping mall sits on what was once our acreage. The town of Farmington has also grown and modernized. My family's year of living among the 2x4s was not always easy, but by working together, we finally achieved a completed home of our own. A House of Our Own was written by Mary E. Hansen. And with that, we're at the end of today's edition of The Good Old Days. I'm Jerome Manigan, inviting you to join me again next week, same place, same time, for another journey back in time to the good old days. Bye-bye. The Good Old Days was recorded in the studios of Radio Reading Services, WRRS, the voice of information by Mark DeWitt.